Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hi, Teresa.
It is very good to have you here today. Carry on from last week. We covered Mary and Fatima, apparitions at Fatima.
Right. And what we're going to be doing today, basically, is looking at the pontificate of Pius XI and some of the very difficult things he had to deal with because he's surrounded by a bunch of fascists. And so these are hard times. He is elected in 1922, and by the time he dies in 1939, you've gone through several minor, very ugly civil wars, the rise of fascists in a number of Western European countries, including Italy itself. You also have the rise of communism in several countries, and the spread of communism from Russia, just as Mary had predicted and prophesied, and then let's not forget the Great Depression.
Right.
So all of those things were happening pretty much at the same time.
Not a fun time to look back on, poor Pius.
Yeah. But once again, I mean, we end up with one of these really incredible popes that he's just turns out to be the perfect person for that particular era.
Funny how that works, isn't
Yes,
it?
Isn't it? Though? Yeah. Well, anyway, he was elected in 1922 in February when Benedict died, and he was the Archbishop of Milan.
Okay.
Had been Archbishop for about 1 year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was not among the Papabile. All the people who knew the Vatican affairs put their money on people like Marie Daval, Maffei, the Archbishop of Pisa, or of course Cardinal Gasparri, the Secretary of State. But he ends up being elected.
That calls to mind me that saying, "Well, as you come to Rome as a pope, you leave as a cardinal."
And the vast majority of them do. And he chooses the title Pius the 11th.
Okay.
And so he's standing in that tradition of Pius the 10th, Pius the 9th, particularly. And right from the very beginning, he does something that is unexpected. And the first act he does is to go to the external balcony of St. Peter's Square.
Oh, okay.
And he blesses the people there. This is the Orbi et Orbi blessing. Now, that's not such a big deal for us. We expect that. However, that blessing had not come from that balcony in 75 years.
Wow. Okay.
And what he was doing was, by blessing the world and blessing the people of Rome, he was making a clear statement that it was his intention during the time that he would be pontiff that he was going to solve the Roman question. The big problem, of course, that had come about in 1870 with the seizure of the Papal States and then the voluntary imprisonment of Pius the Ninth, and the Pope's continuing that isolation and throughout that time, he's going to change this. Okay, let's take a look at his life because he's an interesting character. His name is Achille Ratte. He was born in Milan. Milan is a northern industrial city. It's a big industrial city on the Po River Valley. He comes from a lower middle class family, industrial workers. His father was the director of a spinning mill for textiles. And it's blue collar. He was born in 1857. And very early on in his life, knew that he was being called to the priesthood and went to the seminary. He seems to have been a pretty good student in the seminary, but what impressed his archbishop more than anything else was his serious nature.
Oh, okay.
In fact, the Archbishop of Milan, and I don't know who it is offhand, but had once commented on this young seminarian, and he called him a young old man. And he was just very serious, ordained at the age of 22.
Wow.
You know, quite young. And his pastime basically was to read history. He loved history, especially history of the local area around Milan and Lombardy, that area there. After a number of assignments at the age of 50, he was assigned to be the prefect of Milan's Ambrosiana Library. This is the library, the great city library that's named after St. Ambrose. And this is in 1907. He was absolutely, I mean, who could ask for anything more?
A historian in his
glory. Yeah, he's an historian, a bookworm, and what do? They surround him with books. So he was in his element. There was only one other thing that really just grabbed the passion of this man, and he was a priest who loved to hike and a mountain climb. Not unlike our own
Pope.
Our own present Pope, you know. He was quite a mountaineer. He has on his record having climbed Mount Rosa, which is an 11,000 meter mountain.
Wow!
This is up in the Alps. I mean, that's something. He also conquered Mount Blanc.
Oh, okay.
You know, uh-huh. And also the Matterhorn.
Oh my gosh. So we're not just out for a Sunday stroll here.
No, this guy's serious. And I think, you know, my own measly mountain experiences, I was pretty excited about getting to the top of Mount Antero out in Colorado one time. And that's the fourth highest peak in the state of Colorado.
Oh,
and
that's pretty good.
But I have a funny feeling that that's nothing in comparison to these that Father Ratti had gotten. By 1911, so he had been basically in this position close to 4 years when he caught the attention of Pope Pius
X. Okay.
And he decided that anybody that was that good at running a library ought to be running the Vatican Library.
Oh.
And so with that, he was sent to the Vatican, and he then became the prefect of the Vatican Library. There he stayed, and I guess probably intended to spend the rest of his life, except that the next pope also thought that he might have some diplomatic skills. And so Benedict XV would send Father Ratti off to do diplomatic missions. He served in Poland, in Lithuania, and in Silesia. It's the southern part of today, part of Poland. And so he found himself now not trained as a diplomat, but doing diplomatic work. And finally then, at the age of 64, he was called back to Italy, and this time named the Archbishop of Milan, and made a cardinal at the same time. I mentioned that this was the appointment was in 1921, and by 1922, early 22, there was a conclave. And so he found himself there. He had to learn very quickly, as the Archbishop of Milan, he had to learn very quickly the intricate relationships between the church and the society that was in turmoil in mm-hmm. Europe after the First World War. Lots of political unrest going on, both in Italy and certainly in all of Europe. A lot of, with the rise of the socialist parties. At the same time, you also have contests with the Christian Democrats, and these are those parties that are formed basically out of church groups that are representing or defending the church's prerogatives in society.
Okay.
You know, although some of them can be pretty independent also. And then at the same time, there's a new voice that's coming into the political arena, and that is one arguing for national unity, which on the surface sounds pretty good, but also is arguing that the nation is above everything else, above class, and so it's anti-socialist, but it's also above individuals. So and this, of course, is fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take a little look later on at fascism, especially as it applies to the developments in Nazi Germany. because I think it's very important for us to understand the tremendous attack on the church. And there it's in its purest attack. In Italy, in Spain, in some of the other countries we'll mention in passing, it's not as strident as you find in Nazi Germany. Anyway, in 1922, this is a turning point. The leader of this fascist movement in Italy, Benito Mussolini, mm-hmm. ordered a march on Rome, in which fascists all throughout the country would go to Rome and demonstrate there. They're known as the Black Shirts because that's what they wore, was black uniforms. And they were ordered by Mussolini, as they were going to Rome, that they should show respect for the clergy.
Okay.
There is a huge rally that takes place in St. Peter's Square. Thousands and thousands of these Black Shirts expressing their support for the Pope. So at this point, I mean, there's mixed signals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are these guys your friends? Or are they not? You know, who are they? They're certainly anti-communist, so that's a good sign.
Right.
But, you know, they weren't really showing their colors at this mm-hmm. point yet. You know, in fact, that same year, in October of 1922, there was even an editorial in the Osservatore Romano that was favorable toward Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
And said, well, this man, he can bring some order to a chaotic situation. He's got some interesting ideas. Not only was he getting some support then from some circles within the church, but also he got a lot of support from the government. The king himself, Victor Emmanuel, invited Mussolini to become the prime minister of Italy. And he does that. Now, he's got two titles. Mussolini is prime minister, okay, of the government. At the same time, he's also the leader of the fascist mm-hmm. party, which is known, of course, as Il Duce.
Okay.
Now, Pius finds himself playing a very careful game of diplomacy. Remember, this is a man who is not schooled in diplomacy, but he's had some experience. In the post World War I era, particularly, and so he avoids socialists as one would expect, but he also found himself forbidding Italian clergy from entering into politics, or for that matter, joining political parties.
Mm-hmm.
This was important to do because it wouldn't take too much for a priest or a bishop to find himself in a political party, and then, you know, then the tail ends up wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so he was very careful of that. One of the things that he found himself having to deal with was a third way, I guess you could say, in Italian politics. There was a priest in Italy who was very charismatic, and he organized literally millions of people around a political movement that was known as the Populari. And these were not fascists, and they were not socialists. And on the surface, they were doing the kinds of things that the Pope would want to see done. They were certainly supporters of Catholic Action and the Catholic agenda. One of the things that made it difficult for them during this period, the early 1920s, was one of their tenets was toward absolute pacifism, which became really difficult mm-hmm. For them to live out because both the fascists and the socialists had paramilitary wings, and for all practical purposes. Fascists had a bunch of guys that were known as the Fasci di Combattimento, and they were there to do a little combattimento, break heads and burn up political headquarters and break up rallies and things like that. And so the Popolari were at a disadvantage, not being able to defend themselves. And then also at the same time, again, you have the Pope very concerned about a priest being so involved in political issues like this. One of the things then that he was going to be working toward, especially as he finds Mussolini now as the prime minister, is going to be ultimately the Concordat of 1929 and accompanying that the Lateran Treaties of 1929. This actually has a long history to it. Pius IX had been, remember his opening first act was to bless the world and bless the people of the city of Rome. What he did was he entered into a whole series of concordats. Now, if you remember, you have to go back quite a way to come up with a concordat. Mm-hmm. The one that pops into my mind, of course, is the Concordat of 1801 between Napoleon and Pius the Seventh. But these are relatively rare. Not with Pius XI. Started out the very first year he was Pope. He signed a concordat with the country of Latvia.
Okay.
And then by 1927 had signed other concordats with Romania and Lithuania.
I have a date wrong there. The concordat with Latvia is what year?
1922.
Oh, 22.
What did I say?
29. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it could have been me. 20. Okay.
But yeah, there was 22, and then two of them in 27. So that you can see that when he enters into the one in 1929, that he already has a system underway. And of course, this one is going to solve the Roman question. And just a refresher on that, remember that it has to do with the loss of the Papal States and therefore the non-territorial nature of the papacy, a promise on the part of the Italian government of what they call the laws of guarantee, where the Pope could use certain buildings, traditionally part of his entourage, but they were not his. They were technically owned by the Italian people. And then there was also a certain amount of money that was set aside each year for their use, but of course the popes had been refusing that, and so that was simply sitting in escrow. The first move toward this concordat was actually made by Mussolini.
Okay.
And in a sense, he sort of had the same cynical religiosity of Napoleon Bonaparte. Remember, Napoleon went ahead and embraced Catholicism because France was Catholic.
People. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the people. And Mussolini has the same sense that Italy is Catholic and therefore he has to come in terms. He is very clearly an atheist. All of his writings have never said anything else than that. But as he was in the process of replacing liberals and liberal Democrats within the government and replacing them with fascists and more conservatives and Christian Democrats where he needed to, he wanted to find then some kind of a way of bringing about a détente between the state and the church. And what gave him the first opportunity for that was a Methodist. There was a minister who came to Rome, was intending to establish a Methodist college within sight of the Vatican itself.
Okay.
And so, operating through a third party, this Methodist minister bought some buildings in order to establish this Methodist college. And, of course, the Vatican was absolutely incensed when they found out who was behind this and what was going on, but they couldn't do anything about it. And so they waited to see this college be built, and it never was. The buildings were never torn down, the old buildings. Mm-hmm. There were no new buildings being built up. Nothing happened. And they quietly found out through back channels that Mussolini had put pressure on the city government of Rome not to give building permits to this guy. And so ultimately he ended up having to sell the property, and the whole scheme went for naught. You know, this caught the attention of Cardinal Gasparri. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a controversial character, certainly in history. There's a great story about him at one time at a diplomatic gathering. And it was an informal party, and people were talking and all this. And the French ambassador to Italy went right up to Cardinal Gasparri and accused him of lying. He in fact, caught him in a lie. Well, diplomats do those kind of things, you know. And the cardinal responded back with saying this. He said this: "I do what every diplomat does, but I have the advantage that my sovereign, the Pope, can absolve me of my sins."
Okay. You know?
Well, anyway, he's going to be the chief negotiator for the Vatican in this concordat and in the Lateran treatise itself. And in fact, there's a conversation that takes place between the cardinal and Il Duce after they had pounded out the concordat and came to the conclusion of it. And Cardinal Gasparri said to Mussolini, he said, "But you're not going to have enough votes in the Chamber of Deputies, you know, to pass this thing." And Mussolini said, "Oh, don't worry about that." He said, "We'll just change the Chamber of Deputies. In other words, I'll just call for new elections." And the cardinal's response was, "Well, short of changing the Constitution, there's no way that you're going to change the deputies, the Chamber of Deputies, because the people simply elect the same people back again." And Mussolini's response was, "Well, then I'll change the Constitution." Mm-hmm. And then Cardinal Gasparri later on reflected and to someone else and said, "At that moment, I knew this was a man I could deal with."
Like-minded, eh?
Yeah. Well, it was like pulling teeth for both of them. It was not a good experience. And after a very long, I think it went on for about 2 years,
Wow. This
negotiation, by the time they finally ended up with the Lateran treaties, they had something that they could deal with and something that Pius could be happy with, solving the Roman question. First of all, Italy renounced any claim to the Vatican territories, which became known as the Vatican City. Okay? And it becomes then an independent sovereign state.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's 108.7 acres. So it's, you know, quite small. It's the smallest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one commentator mentioned that in the end, the smaller the better. You don't need a big space. In fact, it just complicates things. It's good to have a little tiny country like this. The Vatican then responded by renouncing any claim to what had been the Papal States prior to 1869, 1870. Well, that's a free giveaway, you know, because they weren't going to get in. Yeah, right, yeah. Then the question came up about the money. And actually, over that period of time, that 50, 60 years, there had not been a payout of any of that money. It had accumulated. Well, actually, as governments have a tendency to do, there is no such thing as a locked box.
Mm-hmm.
It was there only in
thought.
Thought only. And so the Italian government tried to lowball the figure. The Vatican tried to highball the figure. And in the end, the Vatican didn't get all that it actually had coming to it.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of money that would have come year by year to an annual subsidy to the Pope was not anywhere near what they ended up getting. It was far beyond what they ended up getting. But what they got was an upfront check for 750 million lira.
Okay.
Okay, that was nice.
Yeah.
And then also another 1 billion lira in Italian bonds at 5%. So, you know, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they were supposed to get 2 point something other or 3 billion lira. Mm-hmm. So they ended up losing over a billion lira on the whole thing. But what really becomes significant is that once you enter into the Depression, those bonds paying off at 5% are incredibly high.
Yeah.
You know, so the Vatican just milked those bonds as long as they possibly could.
Uh-huh.
And kept them from maturity. So anyway, there's the Lateran treaties, and the Concordat itself is important. It restores the dual nature of a Catholic wedding. Until now, a couple could be married in a Catholic church, but for it to be registered civilly, they would have to go down and be married in the court system. Now the priest would both represent the government as well as the civil as well as the religious. And there were a number of other things that went along with this too. The reopening of Catholic schools, the teaching of Catholic catechism in the Italian public schools.
Yeah,
and they didn't have a lot of curriculum, but they did teach religion in most European schools, religion is taught in the public school systems. And as often as not, it's a combination of like a comparative religions course. But in Italy, it was going to be then, since Catholicism would be the official religion of Italy, it would be Catholic catechism. Now, as time went on, Mussolini began limiting that, you know, as you can imagine. But there, nonetheless, it was there. And then also a number of other organizations were guaranteed freedom, like, for instance, the Catholic Action Organizations, which we'll talk a little bit about later, and then also the Italian Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, which the Catholic Church was very much involved in as a sponsor. Ultimately, they're going to be forced out of existence, and all the children are going to be brought into a fascist youth organization. They had a bottom-up organization that was just incredible. Ultimately, every Italian youth had to belong to this, but they started at the age of 6.
Wow.
And you were slowly indoctrinated. There were different levels, and you were indoctrinated level by level until at the age of 21, you, after going through all of that, then you would be admitted into the fascist party. And so, you know, there was a lot of indoctrination going on, and they were not at all going to allow a rival like the Catholic Church to have that kind of access to education. Well, that wasn't the only problem that Pius XI had to deal with. He had a lot of other problems too, and one of those was over in France. There you had a government that had been anti-clerical at the turn of the century, but had really, after the First World War, the government rethought its own anti-Catholicism, particularly from the point of view of the incredible patriotism of French Catholics. Remember the whole two nations of France thing. And remember that the army tended to be very Catholic and very white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time World War I came to an end, France had to recognize the incredible sacrifice. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the millions of men who were killed in these battlefields. And they had to recognize then that the army was loyal to the country and willing to bleed and sacrifice for the country. And the army was, by and large, Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a sort of a rapprochement between the two nations of France that happens. Well, almost, because there was an element within the white France, very, very conservative group that called themselves the Action Française. It was founded in 1899, and it had fought a constant running battle with Leo XIII, as Leo XIII was trying to bring about better relations between the church and the French government, which was hard to do because the French government back at the turn of the century was very anti-Catholic. But he was trying to go the extra mile. If you remember, Archbishop Lavigueri gave away a lot of his own influence by supporting the Pope in this, and as a result suffered his mission activities with the White Fathers in Africa. Well, the leader of the Action Française, he's one of these guys who is more papal than the Pope, kind of a fellow. His name is Charles Maurras, and he was editor as well as the founder of a newspaper, also called the Action Française. He found himself running up against, well, not only Leo XIII, but also against Pius X, Benedict the 15th. Both Pius X and Benedict the 15th came very close to promulgating a letter condemning the Action Française and Maurras himself. Finally, he even defies Pius the 11th openly in 1926. And with that, the Archbishop of Paris forbade any practicing Catholic from reading the L'Action Française newspaper, and all of the publications were put on the Index of Forbidden Books. So that sort of nipped that in the bud, but always you're going to have that little contest going on there. Things are not exactly happy down in Spain either. We've already talked a little bit about the terrible situation over in Portugal, all the way until 1917, and then quite a change that takes place in Portugal, as you can imagine. But Spain, there were also problems. In 1909, there was a terrible uprising in Barcelona. Here you had proletarians that were rampaging through the city, and it was a very, not only was it proletarian, not only was it socialist, but it was also very anti-clerical. 138 priests in that one riot, 138 priests were murdered.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what happens is that after this terrible bloodbath, that the regime, the government of Spain, put down the rebellions and held things in check. But by the late 1920s, there's a lot of foment. Again, Spain is a divided country. And in 1931, the socialists actually won a majority in the legislature, actually gained control of the legislature. And when they did that, they simply declared a Spanish republic. Now, this republic would remind you of Paris of 1793. It was very radical, had its own civil constitution of the clergy, all those things all over again, very anti-clerical, confiscation of church properties, closing of schools, monasteries, I mean, the whole nine yards. And in 1933, after just two years of this, in the next legislative elections, the socialists lost the election. However, they refused to relinquish control. And so now you had a situation in which the legislature was being held hostage by a group of socialists who refused to give up the power, despite the fact that they had lost a free election. There is confusion in Spain from 1933 all the way to 1936. Because there's no central authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have the so-called Spanish Republic, which has now lost legitimacy, but continues to hold power. You know, in 1936, then what happens is that there is a Spanish general who leads his troops out of Morocco. Spain had control over parts of Morocco, and so he found a way to get his troops off of Morocco, North Africa, back onto the Iberian Peninsula into Spain, and then with that, literally march on Madrid. to overthrow the Spanish government,
okay.
The illegitimate Spanish government. Right. But then he's no more legitimate than they are.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Francisco Franco.
Oh, okay.
This is a civil war, and this is a very brutal and savage civil war. And there's a lot of atrocities on both sides, and a lot of priests are being murdered, priests, nuns, seminarians, murdered by socialists who are being aided by another foreign power who is sending in advisors, small arms, whatever else they could. The Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics.
I had a feeling that's who it was.
Yeah. Well, Franco, of course, now is having difficulties opposing both the Republicans, and these are Spanish Republicans, obviously, and the Soviets. And so he turns for help, and he finds help from Benito Mussolini,
mm-hmm.
who sends quote-unquote volunteers, basically they're Italian troops who have been volunteered to go to Spain to fight, and then also Adolf Hitler, who sends in not so much ground troops, but rather high-tech weaponry.
Oh.
And some of the experiments that the German army had been involved in the early 1930s, they were going to send those in. And literally what they did was they did experiments on the Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the new weapons, the Stuka dive bomber, using that tactically, the Messerschmitt 109, the tanks, tank columns, tank tactics, all those things were being sent to Spain, and then literally they were studied as to how the success, how it worked or didn't work. And so they had a sort of a test tube laboratory to work with. In the end, Franco wins. The Spanish Republic is crushed, and then he continues then to be the dictator. Once again, took the name the leader, El Caudillo, and he stayed in power until 1976.
Oh my gosh!
Isn't that something?
Yeah,
I tend to forget that sometimes.
That's a long time.
Yeah,
this
right.
Is 36 to 76?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, and I remember him dying. Now that I, you know, look back on it, I remember his death and funeral. And then after that, then Spain reverted to a constitutional monarchy, which is what it is today. Yeah. But those are really some tough times, and this was very difficult for the church to be involved in this because it was definitely suffering at the hands of one side, and at the same time didn't want to necessarily endorse this other side.
Right.
You know, I'd mentioned that one of the ways that Pius the 11th was trying to walk that tightrope was through these concordats. And he signed on a number of other concordats then, too, later into the 1930s with the Dollfuss government of Austria, which was a democratic government, but it was very heavy-handed. Now we look back on it and we romanticize the Dollfuss government. But, you know, and it, we get this image of Sound of Music,
right.
You know. It wasn't quite that nice. and then you look over at Hungary, and he signed a concordat with Admiral Horthy over there. Once again, a pretty much of a fascist himself. But and then Franco signed a concordat with him, and then Hitler a concordat with Germany. Pius the 11th referred to these. Not publicly, but among the people at the Vatican, as repugnant alliances. You know, he doesn't particularly
care. That's a pretty good name. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the, repugnant. I just mentioned this real fast to you, one of the quotes I came across years back, and I haven't seen it since, but I think it's probably true. Maybe it's apocryphal, but it's a good story anyway, is that there was a summit happening in Rome in which Adolf Hitler was taking the train and coming to Rome to meet with Benito Mussolini. And the two were going to have this big Axis summit, you know. And someone asked Pius XI whether he was going to be in Rome so that he could receive these two leaders, you know. And his response, and it might be apocryphal, but it's a great story. His response was, "No, I'll be out of town that day. I don't think I could stand the stench."
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
What he's trying to do with these concordats is to get greater freedom of movement within these oppressive societies so that he could then, first of all, protect the church and churchmen, and then also be able to criticize the worst practices of these governments. And by 1931, he felt pretty comfortable in doing that. I mean, just 2 years after he signs the Lateran Treaties and the Concordat, he promulgates an encyclical. This is in June of 1931 in Italian. And the title of it is, and forgive my Italian here, is a Non Abbiamo Bisogno. I'm sorry. What it means is we do not need.
Ah.
And the whole encyclical talks about and critiques fascism itself, basically saying we do not need this. We don't need fascism. We don't need what it stands for, and particularly something that he refers to as the pagan adoration of the state. It's simply not good for us. And also in the same letter, he strengthens his support for Catholic action groups. These are basically lay people who are trying to apply Catholic moral teachings to social affairs. And even before that, just a month before that, on May 15th, he promulgates the other great encyclical, another great encyclical of his pontificate, Quadragesimo Anno.
Mm.
And here he builds on Rerum Novarum, of course. And we tend to look at this, you know, we tend to look at Quadragesimo Anno from the point of view of that building on of Rerum Novarum and in an abstract kind of a way. But the reality is that this particular encyclical comes in 1931, literally 1 month before the other We Do Not Need encyclical, and it is a critique of contemporary society.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the midst of the Depression and right in the midst of fascism. It in a sense then gives a literary support to something else that Pius had done back in 1925. And that's when he declared that the last Sunday in October would be given over to Christ the King.
Mm.
And so the Feast of Christ the King was introduced at that point. Listen to what he said when he promulgated that directive. The reason for doing this, for having a feast for Christ the King, was, quote, to bring home to mankind the fact that Christ is King, not merely of individuals, but of families and societies, of states, of nations, of rulers, of tribunals as well. The duty of Catholics is to hasten the return of the world to His, Christ's authority by their prayer, their influence, and their action. Okay? So their prayer, their influence, and their action. It becomes very important. The whole idea behind this, and we see this permeating into Quadragesimo Anno, is that all of us are meant to operate as members of the mystical body. And we're united in that. We're, first of all, united with God as members of the mystical body of Christ. Later on, Pius XII is going to take this another notch up with Mystici Corporis, that great encyclical. Then he points out that we are united, first of all, each individual to God, but also each of us is united with each other. First of all, through our pastors, and then through the bishops. And the bishops themselves are united in their nations, so synods, you know, conferences, to pursue social aims in order to bring about Christ's kingship. And of course, the bishops themselves are united to the Pope. And so you have a single unity. And so if we see Quadragesimo Anno in context, in the context of the social things that are going on, we see that, first of all, you've got unbridled capitalism that has led to a world that has what the Pope refers to as hard, cruel, and relentless. Well, we've already talked about that, the whole creation of the proletariat. It's just simply wrong to treat people like that. There's no dignity in that. And, of course, the expression of that lack of dignity in 1931 was the Great Depression, mm-hmm. which was worldwide. And there you had 25, 30, 40, 45% of the population unemployed. The other side of this is that Marxism and socialism is not the answer either. Pius refers to them as being impious and nefarious communists. He will also argue that moderate socialism is incompatible with religious life. All you're doing is doing communism light. It doesn't work that way. And so what is the solution? And in Quadragesimo Anno, he talks about a cooperation between the factors of labor and the factors of capital, so that the two understand that when they work together in harmony, that they actually increase prosperity for all, rather than the two of them going at each other and seeing each other as natural enemies. Mm-hmm. They work with each other in order to produce even more. And, of course, then you also have, in 1937, the other encyclical that he's so famous for, and that's the one that he does in German, which I can pronounce better than Italian, Mit Brennender Sorge. And there he attacks Nazism, attacks National Socialism. He attacks Hitler and Hitler's government in the following way. He talks about, first of all, and I'm quoting here, the violations of the Concordat, the many forms of oppression of the freedom of organized religion, the idolatry of race and blood, the horrendous campaigns of scandals against the clergy, the battle against Catholic education, and the suppression of the press. So these are all indictments that he had. This was very difficult for him to be able to promulgate this, to publish this in Nazi Germany. This was, you know, Germany was not an open society by any means. And so what he did was he smuggled the encyclical into Germany, and then there were presses there that ran this off clandestinely. And this was just an incredible feat. Mm-hmm. What they did was they got the encyclical to every Catholic priest in Germany to have it read at Mass on a specific day, and they got away with it. The Gestapo, the SS, all the SD, all of the secret organizations were fooled, and this actually took place. In fact, at one point, the Pope actually considered the possibility of cutting off relations with and repudiating then the Concordat with Adolf Hitler. And he was persuaded not to do that by the Secretary of State, who had been Secretary of State since 1930. This is Eugenio Pacelli. Mm-hmm. And Pacelli thought that he could work with the National Socialists, that you don't want to burn the bridges necessarily.
Right.
And there's some interesting reasons for that. One argument he had was that, at least in 1933, as we'll see a little bit later on, when Hitler came into power, he did not have absolute power. and there were a number of controls on him. The president, he was not the president of Germany. Paul von Hindenburg was. There had been an election in 1932, the year before he became chancellor, and he lost that election. Hindenburg, 84 years old, senile, beat him. Mm-hmm. You know, so the only time the German people ever had an opportunity to vote for Adolf Hitler, they didn't.
Right.
So he had that going. His vice chancellor, his second in command, was a man by the name of von Papen. And von Papen was a very devout Catholic and a member of the Christian Democrats. The Christian Democrats were still a significant force within the German parliament. And without their votes, the National Socialists, the Nazis, could not pass legislation. Mm-hmm. So the deal is that if you're looking at it from Charlie's point of view, that if you're playing within the box, Hitler's been boxed in.
Right.
But what nobody counted on, of course, was that Hitler wasn't playing in the box.
Right.
Yeah. There was another encyclical also in 1937, Divini Redemptoris, in which Pius condemned communism and any other regime that suppressed the freedom of religion. And so, in a sense, then, toward the end of his pontificate, he began turning away from his own foreign policy at the beginning of his pontificate. In the 1920s and early 30s, it was one of active engagement with other powers, mm-hmm. even disreputable powers, mm-hmm. in order to get some wiggle room so as to be able to have some influence in societies. By the end of the 30s, he is either openly or hinting at repudiating his own deals that he's made with these governments, and he's used what freedom he was able, he's using that wiggle room in order to condemn the very worst abuses in their countries. One other thing I guess I just need to mention, is an interesting fun fact, is that he is the first pope in the history of all the popes to hire a woman to work in the Vatican.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
She was a chambermaid, just a little Italian servant girl, and there was objection to it. And someone was bold enough to say to the Pope, no Pope has ever done this before. And Pius the 11th's response was, well, that means that I shall be the first. just like that. By February of 1939, Pius had become so concerned of the way things were going, and if you remember, by that time, by February 19, well, the clock is running.
Mm-hmm.
World War II starts in September of 1939. Unless you're going to follow the timeline of Fatima, which she would argue that
it's already started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's got some good diplomatic reasons mm-hmm. for that. He realizes that, mm-hmm. and he realizes that he needs to use some really tough medicine now in addressing this. And so in February of 1939, Pius IX called together all the bishops of Italy to come to the Vatican. And so here they are. They're all coming. He told them already he was going to give an important address, a very important address to them. So you can imagine now, they're coming in from all over Italy in order to hear the Pope. And the next morning, when everyone got up, he didn't get up.
Mm-hmm.
Pius XI had suffered a massive heart attack that night and died in his sleep. And there's been great speculation ever since then as to the timing of this has been too impeccable. The notes that he had that he was going to read to the cardinals and bishops of Italy were put away and put into a secret archives, and they were not published until January of 1959. So it's way after the war, years and years later it's gone by. And basically it was a virulent condemnation of Mussolini, mm-hmm. and the violations of the Lateran Treaty that Mussolini had done over these past 10 years, and also a condemnation of Hitler's persecution of peoples, all different sorts of peoples, and his militarism, mm-hmm. and that this was leading to another great war. And but of course he never had the opportunity to make that speech. Things pretty much sat the way they were until, as I say, in 1959, the speech was made public. And then in 1972, there was an article that was published in the Paris magazine called Match. And in that article, it speculated that someone very close to the Vatican had information that Pius had actually been murdered that night, that the heart attack had been chemically induced. And he pointed the finger at a particular doctor, Francesco Petacci, and said that there was certainly a lot of circumstantial evidence that would show that he had the opportunity to do this. And so anyway, the source of this particular article was none other than Cardinal Tisserand. So take that for what it's worth. Later on, the Vatican was questioned on this, and they responded by saying that the charges were ridiculous and there was nothing to it, and he had died a natural death, and it was just a bad circumstance and all of that. But nonetheless, that article that appeared in 1972 has raised enough questions as to whether or not Pius had been murdered or not. I'd like to just end with a quote from a book. It's entitled The Destruction of the European Jew, and it's by Raoul Hilberg. It's a three-volume set. It is probably the most scholarly work done on the Holocaust. It's just an excellent, excellent book. And in this book, Hilberg talks a little bit about Pius the Ninth, and particularly the reaction that he received from the Italian government concerning one of his speeches, a speech that he had made in 1938.
Okay.
Okay, just a paragraph, but I think it says something about the incredible pressure that the Vatican was working under, that Pius XI was working under, that Pius XII was going to inherit a couple days later.
Okay.
Okay. It says this: in July, Pope Pius XI made a speech violently critical of racism. The Pope's remarks were received with something less than good humor by the fascist leader, to whom racism implied not a mere assertion of power vis-a-vis Jewry, but, more importantly, a feeling of superiority over the recently conquered African populations of the empire. We're talking about this new Italian empire that Mussolini had created. Upon hearing of the papal criticisms, Foreign Minister Ciano called the nuncio, Borgonini, Duca, to express his displeasure. Ciano pointed out that the Duce, Mussolini, regarded the racial question as fundamental. It was the lack of racial preparedness which had caused the Abhara insurrection in Ethiopia. Ciano's entry, this is in his own diary, and Ciano's diary is one of the great insights we have into the mind of Mussolini. This is a relative of Mussolini's, and he's also the foreign minister. He said this, and I quote here from his diary, mm-hmm. I spoke quite plainly to Borgonini, explaining the premises and aims of our racial policy. He seemed pretty convinced. And I may add that he showed himself personally very anti-Semitic. He will confer with the Holy Father tomorrow. End quote. Mussolini himself was worked up about the Catholic offensive, and in a state of agitation gave his son-in-law Ciano an order for an anti-Jewish measure. He wanted all Jews to be struck off the diplomatic list. I think the key here is that This is fascism light in comparison to Nazi Germany. Right. But you can see that whenever the Vatican pushes, there's a counter push.
Right.
And Pius was well aware of this. I mean, after all, he was the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
And he was aware that when you make an overt statement condemning something in fascism, you can expect to have not only an attack back on you, but also another object. In this case, when Pius XI makes a statement condemning Italian racism, what happens? All Italian diplomats, or anyone in the diplomatic service who was Jewish, was simply dismissed. They all lost their jobs. Now that's a tragedy for anyone, certainly, in their career. But you can see that when it starts getting into the really huge matters of millions of people sent off to death camps, this is the modus operandi
right.
that you're dealing with these fascists.
Father, can we close quickly with a prayer today?
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end.
Amen.